President Trump wants to acquire Greenland. That's focused attention on the question of independence for the territory.
I don't think right now we are ready.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. How Greenland sees its political future, and in Peru, an indigenous population may not be isolated for long.
They know how to live well in the forest, and they are very afraid of what will happen to them if they come out.
Also, a possible climate solution for protecting Arctic sea ice. Make it thicker.
It could be 1 or 2 feet thicker. That would be enough to last, you know, a few weeks longer in the summer.
Plus, saving people from organized crime in Southeast Asia, and he's appropriate for any occasion.
It's universal. Anyone can like Ed Sheeran. Very rarely is it offensive in any way.
Today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. We begin in Greenland. The Arctic territory was very much in the global spotlight earlier this year after President Trump renewed talk about wanting to acquire it.
We need it really for international world security. And I think we're going to get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it.
That was a joint session of Congress reacting. In Greenland, a survey at the time showed that the vast majority of Greenlanders did not want to be part of the United States.
But Greenlanders have long been wrestling with questions of identity and independence from Denmark. Greenland's prime minister at the time, Mutta Era, put it this way.
We don't want to be Danes. We don't even want to be Americans. We want to be Greenlanders.
The outside attention has faded, but the internal conversation has not stopped. I spent some time in Greenland recently to see if the whole ordeal is bringing about any real change. In the capital city of Nuuk, I asked a lot of people what they thought about independence, and most people told me some version of this.
Many Greenlandic people, including me, hoping for independence in our country in future.
This is Lila Frederiksen.
I don't think right now we are ready. Maybe in 10, 20 years from now, I think we're going to be independent.
Frederiksen is a nurse and is walking along Nuuk's seaside boardwalk with her two kids and husband, Christian Kuluk Frederiksen. They talked about independence a lot after Trump's comments.
Yeah, we found out that we do have a very big difference opinion on independence.
He wants independence as soon as possible. She thinks improvements to infrastructure, education, and the economy need to come first. And this about sums up the debate in Greenland right now. Most people and most political parties say they want independence. The question is how fast. Lila Frederiksen is worried about Greenland losing its cultural identity.
I remember my grandfather, when he was young, life is a lot different back then.
Many in her grandfather's generation lived at some point in small settlements, in houses made of sod and hunted seals on kayaks. Frederiksen lives in a modern house in Nuuk and studied in Copenhagen to become a nurse. She says Greenland has changed.
It's more like Danish. It's Danish way of life, Danish way of speaking, Danish culture.
The changes are even more stark for the kids.
On the bus, I usually hear small kids speaking only in English. I was like, oh.
Of course, I'm concerned that our identity as a Greenlanders, our language, our culture will disappear very fast if we don't do anything very
dramatic?
Dramatic changes, yes.
The European influence on Greenland is not new. A statue of Christian missionary Hans Era still stands overlooking Nuuk's old harbor. He is considered the initial colonizer of Greenland.
He's standing up there on the hill looking over Nuuk.
This is Kuno Fenker, a member of parliament. Fenker thinks the statue should be taken down.
We should put him in a museum.
Signs of colonialism and native Greenlandic culture sit side by side here. Not far from the statue is a shop selling local meat. Is that reindeer leg?
Yeah, reindeer, seal. That's whale over here also.
In 1953, Greenland went from being a colony to part of the Kingdom of Denmark. Greenlanders became Danish citizens.
There was no referendum. The people of Greenland was not asked. It was absolutely against all the decolonization processes of the UN back then.
Greenland got its own parliament and government in 1979 and began taking over its own domestic affairs. Fenker is one of the most outspoken proponents for independence, though he prefers a different term.
I think a sovereign state is the right word, and take the sovereignty back of Greenland.
That idea got a lot of traction when Greenland was in the global spotlight. And in a March election, the most aggressively pro-independence party, Fenker's party, got the second most votes, doubling its seats in parliament.
I had some kind of a hope that we could work towards, in a proper way, more independence to Greenland and eventually ask the people of Greenland what they want.
A landmark 2009 act spelled out Greenland's right to self-determination and the next step toward potential independence, a referendum. Fenker hoped to get a vote on a bill calling for that referendum during this term, but the bill was squashed. So is Greenland any closer to independence than it was before your election in March?
It's difficult to say, but if I should give my best guess, it would be no, because the current government doesn't want independence.
That is not what the government says. Eustace Hansen is a member of parliament with the pro-business Democratic Party. It is the biggest party in parliament right now.
Of course, I'm pro-independence, but we have to be very careful when we push that button or sign that document.
I talked to Hansen in his office in East Greenland, which is remote even by local standards. Hansen had cancer recently and had to take a helicopter to a plane to the capital for a diagnosis. And eventually he traveled to Copenhagen for treatment. He says the lack of highly trained local workforce is one reason Greenland is not ready to go it alone.
We are only 56,000 souls here in Greenland, in a very vast and very big area. We don't have enough people that are well educated in our public schools, in our workplaces and so on.
Both Hansen and Fenker agree that Greenland needs a stronger economy before it can stand on its own. About half of the government's budget each year comes from a block grant from Denmark, and more than 90% of its export revenue comes from one source, seafood.
That's why we need to diversify. We need to diversify the economy, and we need to utilize our resources much better than we have done.
In a poll back in January, 56% of Greenlanders said they would vote yes on an independence referendum if it were held immediately. But a significant minority of people I spoke to did not support independence. They liked having access to Denmark's resources, like universities, or feel the island is still dependent on Denmark. Basically, everything in Greenland is imported. And Marie Vild made that point when we talked at a mall in downtown Nuuk.
All of the stuff you have in Babysam, it's imported. And in Itunet, it's all imported.
The stores here in the mall.
Yeah. So you can't say, no, we don't want it.
Her take on independence is complicated.
No, I'm not for or against, but we can't do it ourselves. We are too few people.
Do you think eventually it could work to be independent?
No. No.
This is all very much on Greenlanders' minds heading into the next parliamentary session starting next week. There are proposals on the agenda that could strengthen Greenland on its road to independence by giving Greenland authority over its financial regulations and boosting development of the economy, infrastructure, and education. But there is no agenda item on independence itself.
That was Carolyn Beeler reporting from Greenland. What started with just a few friends has grown into a group of 6,000 people from almost 40 countries. The Women's International Motorcycle Association is celebrating 75 years in the saddle. The world's Bianca Hillier went to their annual international rally to learn more.
At this year's 75th anniversary celebration in Maine, 160 women from 20 countries talk like old friends. Michelle Lamphere is running the show as president of the U.S. chapter. She shows me around the rented-out summer camp where national flags hang outside of cabins.
that's kind of a tradition. They bring their own country's flag to kind of say, hey, we're here. There's New Zealand and Australia. At that next cabin, there's a big yellow inflatable kangaroo. So that's where the Aussies are at. Yeah. You cannot miss them.
Flags for Japan, Scotland, and Uruguay fly nearby. Lamphere says one of her favorite parts of these gatherings is seeing women from across the globe bond over motorcycles, despite speaking many different languages.
They all know the throttle, rolling your hand backwards like a throttle increasing on your bike. Everybody knows that, and they're like, vroom, vroom. That transcends all language barriers.
Of course it does.
Some of the women at the meetup have tens of thousands of miles under their belt, like Linda Bick.
I got into motorcycling when I was about 17 in England.
Since then, she's racked up 62 years on the roads and counting, riding everywhere from Moscow to Cape Town to Adelaide.
God knows how many countries I went through. Just meeting different people, you know, from the different cultures, it's amazing.
Then there are bikers who are new to the open road. Down by the lake, a group of women celebrates one of them.
Hey, everybody, on shore. Tara, right there, just passed her motorcycle license about 2 hours ago.
A couple of beers are raised in the air. I ask Tara why she chose to start riding.
Been through a lot in my life, and something I always wanted to do was ride a motorcycle since I was like 8, 9 years old. And 58 just hit me, and it was like, you know what? Life's too short. I'm going to go do it.
These international rallies are kind of like really cool conferences. There are guest speakers on everything from tips for riding and fixing motorcycles to exploring Mexico by motorcycle. While the bikers have different reasons for getting into motorcycles, they all love them for some of the same reasons.
I feel freedom.
Freedom, independence, doing control of yourself.
You know, and you're just like, hey, I'm a powerful woman. I'm a brave woman.
And you're living in the moment.
Yeah.
You can zone out any thoughts.
Yeah.
Because they're somewhere else. Because right now you need to focus on the road.
Michelle Lamphier says there are usually a lot more people at the international gatherings, up to 300 women. But holding this year's rally in the U.S. was an obstacle for some members.
There was some pushback from some of the Canadian members against attending just because of the political climate in our country and how their country has been made to feel. And we actually had specifically some members from overseas that are part of the LGBTQ community. And they did feel that they might be targeted and that maybe the U.S. was not as safe an environment right now.
Historically, some of the biggest organized groups of women riding motorcycles have been in the U.S. and across Europe. In other regions, it can be a lot harder to find a community. One woman at the rally named An says that's the case where she's from, in Vietnam.
Culture. Yes. It's simpler.
Motorcycles are seen for men, she says, and there isn't a culture of women riding recreationally. She now lives in Finland, though, where the Women's International Motorcycle Association has connected her with more than 300 fellow bikers. Another member named Marta shares a similar experience from Nicaragua.
When I started, it was like, no, you cannot come over here. This group is just only for men, blah, blah, blah. So that type of machismo, you can say, is very difficult in my country. But now, they love me.
Still, in other parts of the world, women face more than cultural barriers. For example, in Iran, there's no explicit ban on women riding motorcycles, but the law says motorcycle licenses can only be given to men. The Women's International Motorcycle Association hopes to build on the movement to change that. They just announced their first ever Iranian national chapter with a local Iranian president last month. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Poland, Maine.
In the jungle along the Thailand-Myanmar border, people from all over the world are trying to make quick money running online scams. Some of them know what they're getting into. Others are duped into thinking they're actually working legit jobs. Up next, how one man is trying to intercept potential victims of these criminal enterprises. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Southeast Asia, whole cities have sprouted up for the sole purpose of crime. On yesterday's show, reporter Patrick Nguyen peered into towns built in the jungles along the border of Thailand and Myanmar. These enclaves are full of people from all over the world coming to make quick money by running online scams. Some know what they're getting into, some don't. Either way, many are forced into slave-like working conditions. Today, Patrick meets someone trying to rescue people from these criminal operations.
A stakeout on a dirt path in Thailand turned to mush by falling rain. Leading this operation was a Thai man, sitting in his Mercedes SUV with his teammates.
My name is Aria, Pisutir Watanapan.
He came here with a rifle in the back seat and a pistol in the center console. He's trying to rescue a young Chinese woman from human traffickers.
So they just sent me the message for help. She gave us a lot of details.
The woman had flown from China to Bangkok for a job doing online work. Her new employers sent some guys to pick her up at the airport in a van. But they started driving her towards Myanmar, a lawless part of Myanmar. She freaked out and sent Arya a message on social media saying, "You don't know me, but I'm in an old Mitsubishi van with two guys. Save me." Arya suspected the van would come down this dirt road.
It's like nowhere, like middle of nowhere.
On the Thai side, it's all cornfields. But across a muddy brown river is Myanmar. Rising from the banks is a notorious criminal enclave. Arya could see these huge compounds towering over the jungle, sky-high buildings with bars on the windows. The young woman did not want to end up there. Once you go in, criminals can take your passport, then beat you or torture you if you don't scam enough people online in a day. So, Arya's team was determined to save her. One of them pulled out a pistol, racking a bullet in the chamber, in a moment that would later appear on TikTok. So the thing about Arya, he is not a cop, he is not even a private eye. He is a 30-something TikToker. And a big deal on China's version of TikTok called Douyin.
How many followers do you have on Douyin?
On Douyin, I have 2 million. And the total got like 5 million. 5 million, yes.
5 million on all social media channels. Arya is a Thai citizen, but ethnically Chinese, so he posts in Chinese under his Chinese name, Hu Chi Dao. Now, why would a woman fearing for her life contact some guy on TikTok? Because he might show up. Authorities are often overwhelmed with the tens of thousands of people getting smuggled into these criminal enclaves. People from India, Kenya, the Philippines, everywhere. Arya is a daredevil, but he does have his limits.
Some message is like, "We stuck somewhere, we cannot come out. Please come in to help us." I said, "No, it cannot be happened. It's impossible."
The scam compounds are run by Chinese crime syndicates with armed guards. And that part of the jungle in Myanmar is ruled by their business partners, a large militia with thousands of troops. So Arya, ideally, tries to rescue people before they go across that river. Some of the operations he posts online. But this is not why he started posting on TikTok. That's Arya on a trip to the U.S. shooting wild boar. By day, he's a businessman from Bangkok. He's into real estate and high-end truck accessories. He also likes to go on adventures around the world, doing cowboy stuff and making videos. But last year, he started getting messages from Chinese fans who'd run afoul of those crime syndicates and thought he might be bold enough to step in. Back to the stakeout on the Thai-Myanmar border. That young woman was one of Arya's first rescues late last year. Her message said she'd been duped by a friend who claimed the job in Thailand would be easy and pay loads of money. Total BS. On that day, Arya's premonition was right. That Mitsubishi van did come down that dirt road with the woman inside.
Of course I'm scared. Because it's first time I'm facing the scammer guy, so I'm scared, yes.
There's footage of Arya hopping out with his buddy. Both were dressed in tactical gear and baseball caps, guns in hand. They looked like special forces.
He don't know we're police or we are something, so he's just like stuck there.
The driver was dumbstruck, like frozen in place. They yanked the sliding door open in a moment that would later end up on TikTok, with Arya narrating breathlessly. The young woman in a black shirt and skinny jeans ran out, right into his Mercedes. Then they peeled out of there.
She's like PTSD. She's like stuck there. So it's like she can't say nothing. So I totally understand.
Arya made sure she got back home to China. Altogether, he has helped, by his estimate, nearly 50 people. Men, women, even teenagers. The problem is, now he gets way too many messages, some of them demanding.
And someone asking me, hey, you go save my family, like order me. Like, I don't like it. It's not my job.
If he sounds jaded, well, look, he says, some people want to be scammers. Not that woman, she was actually tricked, but there are guys who want to go live it up in those criminal playgrounds. They have brothels, open drug use, nightclubs, you name it.
They get karaoke, even the cinema. They even can find, like, girls for fun. They get everything.
Then guys get over there, get treated like dirt, and want out. Arya usually has no idea what happens to the people he helps. But I found someone who has tracked down one of his rescues, a kid named Sihan from China, who is just 14. That's Sihan saying, yeah, I knew I was going to Myanmar, and I knew it was messy over there, but I wanted to try my luck. Sihan was speaking to Kathy Yu. She's a documentary filmmaker based in New York City. That clip of Sihan talking is footage from her forthcoming film on scam compounds. I asked Kathy Yu, how on earth does a teenage boy end up flying abroad to join a scam syndicate?
Because his parents are not around.
Sihan's mom and dad work tough jobs in a nearby city. He got little attention at home and started flunking out of school and then started hanging with a rough crowd.
And then these bad kids, they probably have more time and more energy and they're more friendly to him. And slowly, his life pivoted to that way.
Those friends convinced Sihan to go off and become a scammer. It didn't go well. In the compounds, Sihan was deemed disobedient and beaten over and over. Arya had to orchestrate his rescue, but no commando stuff. Instead, there was a ransom payment. When they finally got the boy out, Sihan was bruised severely on his backside.
His butt was all bruised. His whole butt was like black.
These days, if anyone sends a message to Arya's social media asking for help, he won't answer himself. He's programmed an AI chatbot to reply instead and advise them on escaping. The real Arya? He's out traveling the world, making TikToks, and doing cowboy stuff. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Dak Province, Thailand.
More global stories coming your way this hour. You're with The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Last week, a special government commission in Peru voted to nix plans for a 3-million-acre conservation reserve in the Amazon. It would have helped to protect uncontacted peoples there, that is to say, communities that essentially have zero contact with other communities or the wider world. Peru is among the countries with the most uncontacted indigenous groups on Earth. Activists warn that other such reserves could be on the chopping block in the future. John Reed wrote about this for the Guardian newspaper. He's an environmental economist and joined us from Occidental California.
This is in northeast Peru along the border with Brazil. It's a very remote area. There are no roads. It's very difficult to get into the area. And that's one reason why these uncontacted people are still thriving there.
So this land for the conservation reserve would have been set aside. Why is the government of Peru changing course now?
These reserves have to go through a long and very torturous process to prove that they are, in fact, occupied by human communities, and then go through a series of bureaucratic steps to get approved. This vote that happened last Thursday was the key step in really putting the area over the line. And the people that I interviewed for the story really feel like there's been a shift where the economic interests in Peru in extracting resources from the jungle have really gained so much power that it's difficult to get areas like this protected anymore, even though Peruvian law says it's supposed to be protected.
As for these uncontacted people in this part of Peru, what is known about them? Who are they?
The studies that were done to establish the basis for this reserve estimated there were maybe 600 to 700 people, and they identified from artifacts that were found in the area and the lifestyles that they could observe from aerial photographs and other kinds of evidence that they were from 3 or 4 different ethnic groups. So you have in the area potentially 3 or 4 different cultures and languages that could be put at risk by this decision.
How precarious was this situation for these groups already?
Well, it's quite precarious because the government of the region has repeatedly tried to give logging concessions in the area. A road has been built into the area, and drug trafficking is very active in this region.
I'm wondering if there's been any research on why uncontacted peoples, especially these groups in particular, why they want to be sealed off from other communities.
Well, the last stories that we did about a month ago was actually about a people who is recently contacted, and they can tell in their own words why they don't want contact. Contact was forced on them, and it entails a disastrous mix of disease, of disorientation, of being thrust into the modern world at the lowest, most miserable rung of the social ladder. And so if they don't die from disease, they are thrust into this situation of dependency. They know how to live well in the forest, and they are very afraid of what will happen to them if they come out.
We've been speaking, John, about the people who live in this area, but could this also have an environmental impact?
The environmental impact is huge, Marco, because the areas that are big enough for uncontacted people to continue to live and thrive are almost always very large areas of very intact tropical forest. So we know that these areas have immense value for the biological diversity of the region and the planet, and that they are some of the most resilient storehouses of carbon that help us in our fight against climate change. So the folks who live there need these areas, but at a larger level globally, the rest of us who are coping with the effects of climate change and biodiversity loss also need them.
What is your concern that this move by Peru to cancel the set-aside of 3 million protected acres could be copycatted by other countries?
Well, in a sense, I see Peru copycatting other countries in a sort of a vicious cycle going on, because the rules, the law that Peru has on the books since 2006 to protect isolated peoples says that this area should be established as a reserve. And to find a way to get around the rules and let power have more sway than rules, I think is a trend that we see in various countries around the world right now, when it comes to human rights and to environmental protection. So this is very concerning in terms of being able to protect our environment around the world, because environmental protection depends on rules and about people following them and governments enforcing them.
John Reed is an environmental economist. He joined us from Occidental, California.
Rappers around the world dig into traditional music for stuff to sample.
Negros Tau Moria, or Black Morris, as he's known in English, is from Athens, Greece. He mixes trap beats with a style of Greek folk music known as rebetiko.
It is the sound of Black Morris's childhood, and it inspires him. Black Morris is not a Greek citizen, though, even though he was born there. That's because his parents are immigrants from Ghana, and Greece does not have birthright citizenship. The World's Jerry Haddon has that story.
When Black Morris was getting his start some years ago, he laid out his thoughts on Greek society and his place in it on a radio show called Afropop.
The system, it's racist, you know, my opinion. That's a law. You got to be Greek by blood to have ID. Sometimes I feel Greek, sometimes I feel like a foreigner. There's a whole discrimination when you're black. From the past days to now, you can't change it.
That was in 2017, a turbulent time in Greece. The country was deep in debt and reeling under the pressure of hundreds of thousands of new arrivals, people fleeing war in Syria and other conflicts. The chaos helped a xenophobic neo-Nazi political party called Golden Dawn gain several seats in parliament. But a lot has changed since then. Golden Dawn has been outlawed. Some of its leaders are in prison, implicated in violent attacks on migrants. But anti-migrant attitudes persist. And that's what Black Morris tries to make sense of on his new album, Mavi Elada, or Black Greece. This song speaks about ongoing resentment toward immigrants, even as the economy needs them for affordable labor. It's a contradiction, one that Black Morris tries to challenge musically by fusing local and foreign, old and new, showing how they can work together. Black Morris is not the only Afro-Greek artist tackling social tension in the country. Back during Golden Dawn's heyday in 2013, I met a young rapper in Athens named MC Yinka. MC Yinka was also born in Greece to parents from Africa, in his case, Nigeria. So, like Black Morris, he's not a Greek citizen, but he's hugely popular. I recently caught up with him online to ask for his view on whether Greek society had changed since we first spoke.
After the fall of Golden Dawn, we don't see any fascist or racist like attacks so much. You can say that the society is more familiar, and maybe we can see that we are more visible as time goes by.
That's due in part, he says, to the explosion of musical talent in Athens' immigrant neighborhoods.
They'd be building up an audience, and now people in Athens are more aware of Afro-Greek MCs.
MC Yinka rattles off their names, Black Morris, Moose, Karim Kaloko, all of whom, he says, took up the torch from his generation.
Many Afro-Greek rappers are here doing their thing and blending cultures. This is what I was all about with my music.
Was all about, MC Yinka tells me. With age, he says, he's felt less need to prove his Greekness by including Greek elements in his art.
Just that there's an Afro-Greek artist in Athens just making music and rapping in Greek, and that's, for me, a statement by itself.
This is a song called Divin' from MC Yinka's latest album of the same name. The genre, a mix of grime and deep bass. And instead of exploring identity, where he's from, which passport he holds, it's about searching for self-knowledge on the inside, no matter what's happening outside, on the streets. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
Ice in the Arctic is disappearing. Over the past several decades, warming temperatures driven by climate change have cut in half all Arctic sea ice. A new project hopes to slow down that melting by using seawater to essentially grow thicker ice. Andrea Ceccolini is the CEO of the company behind this experiment. It's called Real Ice. I spoke with him earlier today as part of our Big Fix series about the creative ways people are finding solutions to climate change. We started with the basics of how this ice thickening technology works.
We use a water pump to pump seawater on top of existing ice at the beginning of the winter when the Arctic is still very cold. And this water will freeze very quickly and form an extra layer of ice. Thicker ice will then have more chances to survive longer in the summer when we need it to reflect a lot of radiation back to space.
And how much thicker exactly are we talking?
This is up to us. If we stay in an area and we pump a lot of water, we're talking about it could be 1 or 2 feet thicker. That would be enough to last, you know, a few weeks longer in most places in the Arctic in the summer. So that's the type of target that we have in mind.
So we've covered the how. Tell me about the why. Is it mostly to reflect more of the sun's energy back into space, like you mentioned?
Yes. So the Arctic sea ice in a single day in the middle of the summer can reflect enough energy comparable to all the power produced by all of the humanity power stations in a whole year.
And that energy is in the form of heat. And so if you reflect more of it back into the atmosphere, you're basically decreasing the rate of global warming.
Exactly. So if there was the open ocean, that energy would be absorbed by the planet and then eventually warm up the planet. That's the function that the Arctic has had for a long, long time as a sort of air cooling of the planet.
So you have done some tests on this, some field work, and recently released data from your latest field season. Tell us exactly sort of what you were testing, what you found, and how big of an area you were able to thicken the ice in.
This past winter, we covered an area equivalent to around 50 football pitches, and we created roughly 50,000 tons of new ice to cover that, to give you an idea. So some sizes. So it's still small. It's a fraction of, you know, a square mile or square kilometer, if you want. But large enough to show us the effect of this intervention. And in fact, when we came to the melt season around the end of May, we've been working in Cambridge Bay, by the way, in Canada. When we came to the melt season, we could observe for roughly 5 or 6 weeks that our ice was actually brighter in this period. So it was a promising test. There are areas that we know we need to study more in detail. We'll need to study, for instance, the microalgae that grow under the ice and if there is any impact on those. So far, we don't think there's any major impact. But we'll work with ecologists to make sure that that is assessed properly.
I know you are working alongside some of the communities that live near this area in Cambridge Bay in Canada. Some of the indigenous communities in the area are working alongside your project. Some oppose it. What are their concerns, those who oppose this work?
To be honest, we found actually great support from the community. This will always be a bit controversial. It is a climate intervention. It's active cooling. And there is a position of, you know, not trying to touch the environment in general. People are concerned, but they need to be explained. We tackle this by being transparent in what we do, by seeking for not only approval, but collaboration from the community. They are the real experts of the sea ice in the region, and they're also the legitimate owners of those lands. So it's not just about listening to the concern, it's about seeking collaboration. In the future, we would be really successful if we built something that is then led by the indigenous communities themselves.
So as you said, these are early tests. For this to make any sort of meaningful impact on fighting climate change, it would need to be scaled up a lot. Obviously, it takes energy to pump water and it takes money. Do you think it's likely that this could actually be scaled up in a meaningful way?
Well, we have a plan, we have an idea, we have a model to make it happen. We've done the calculations. I mean, in terms of energy, we are talking about a tiny fraction respect to the energy that we reflect back to space. We want to do it with clean energy. In terms of scaling, we have a plan, and we start to test from this winter the first prototypes, to use underwater drones to automate the operation. I mean, nobody wants to do it manually, you know, with minus 40, minus 50 temperature, strong winds. This is something for machines to do it. That would be very efficient. But clearly, we would need thousands of them to cover a large area. The Arctic is like twice the area of the United States. It's a big area, but
right, a lot bigger than year. 50 soccer fields, right, which was your test area.
Exactly. Although every year at maximum scale, so at full scale, we wouldn't need to cover more than like 5% of that area. But the costs to do these are tiny respect to what we need to pay in terms of climate adaptation or loss and damage that will run into the tens of trillions of dollars over the next few years.
You've spelled out well the goal here, to reflect more energy back into the atmosphere to slow global warming. What would that mean for people all around the world who are very far from the Arctic but might feel some impact?
This means, first of all, buying time for what will actually be the actual solution to climate change, which is decarbonization. We can't go around that. But we need time for that. We are desperately late. The second is the warming of the Arctic region, and it's warming four or five times faster than the rest of the world, exactly because we are losing sea ice, is creating an acceleration in the melting of Greenland glaciers, which is in itself creating sea level rise at accelerated pace. So this is really about risk management. By keeping the Arctic cooler, we don't accelerate this phenomena, which will lead to tipping points, which will be suffered by the whole planet.
Andrea Ciccolini heads up Real Ice, the company behind this project. He spoke with us from London as part of our climate solutions series, The Big Fix.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We will get back to humans in a minute, but first, a moment for two news stories about animals causing mischief, starting in Austria, where there is a moose on the loose.
His name is Emil, or at least that's what Austrians have been calling him. He was first seen in Lower Austria several weeks ago, and now he's in the northeastern part of the country near Vienna, where he's been spotted walking down the street and occasionally stopping trains, including on Saturday near the city of St. Pölten, after the moose fell asleep on the tracks.
We will be standing still for an uncertain amount of time.
That's the conductor on the Vienna-Salzburg line, which got held up for hours while Emil slept.
But despite those inconveniences, Austrians are still pretty excited about Emil. He has a Facebook page tracking his whereabouts with more than 10,000 members. Moose do occasionally visit Austria, but they typically live farther north. The Austrians seem to be good hosts, though, letting Emil roam around wherever he wants.
And in Canada, bees were caught stealing honey, which was arguably theirs to begin with. It's a case you might recall if you saw a bee movie, where a bee voiced by Jerry Seinfeld took honey industry moguls to court.
As a bee, honey's pretty important to me. It's important to all bees. We invented it. We make it. And we protect it with our lives.
But in real life, that's not how the owner of a British Columbia honey company feels. She found the so-called robber bees swarming her workshop.
It took me a minute to realize that, okay, this is a bigger buzz than there should be in here.
That's Christine McDonald of Rushing River Apiaries speaking to the CBC.
I've been working with bees for years, and I don't usually feel any kind of nerves around them. And this was almost a panicky feeling of, I don't know how to stop this.
McDonald explained that the bees are looking for food because they're hungry, and this time of year their hives are supposed to be heavy with honey. But it's been a terrible season and the hives are light. One of the doors to McDonald's own stash of honey wasn't sealed as tightly as she thought, and that's why some hungry bees hit the jackpot.
Each one that finds food goes back and tells 100 friends, and then those bees go back and tell 100 friends. And soon they all knew where the honey was.
McDonald has since sealed up her workshop. Now she is imploring beekeepers in British Columbia to check on their bees' food supply and try to keep them well-fed so they do not go looking elsewhere for sustenance.
The trains in Tokyo are known for three things. They're punctual, they're packed, and they're quiet. But for the next month, that quiet will be shattered as one subway line becomes known for something, or rather, someone entirely different. Ed Sheeran, the world's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel, explains.
On the surface, there's not much that this has in common with this.
The club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go.
But if you dig a little deeper and put your dad joke cap on, you'll realize that Ed Sheeran and Tokyo's Oedo subway line are a marketing match made in heaven. First off, Sheeran is already quite popular in Japan, and he's about to release a new album called Play. The album features a bright magenta cover, the exact same color as the Oedo line on a map. But where things get really good, or bad, depending on your appetite for puns, is in the name. When you say Ed in Japanese, it sounds like Edo. So Warner Music, Sheeran's label, decided to team up with the Oedo line on what's being dubbed the Oedo collaboration campaign.
It's maybe a little clever by half in the sense of Oedo and Ed is maybe too on the nose.
That's George Howard, a music business management professor at Berklee College of Music, where he teaches marketing for artists.
But, you know, at this point in time, whatever you can do to get the word out in a terribly cluttered space is what you have to do.
What they're doing is transforming one entire 8-car train into an Ed Sheeran museum. When unwitting riders hop on to get to work or school, they'll be confronted with a whole lot of Ed Sheeran. Music, trivia, decorations to tell the story of his career. Businesses along the train line will also be doling out merchandise tied to the campaign. The idea, Howard says, is to be fresh, unexpected, and break through the constant slop of TikTok and Instagram content.
There's very definitely a sort of fatigue with respect to the traditional marketing gambits that have now become both de rigueur and also just sort of tired. It's very, very hard to stand out unless you do something, you know, remarkable.
Now, there is one expert who thinks this whole Tokyo subway blitz is remarkable.
My name is Joanne Debenham, and I am the head of marketing for a law firm in England.
Joanne Debenham lives and works in the county where Ed Sheeran grew up. For years, she was aware of Sheeran, but wasn't exactly a fan. Then he played a hometown show in April.
After the concert, I very much embraced him more as an artist. He's so fantastic if you ever get to see him live.
Ahead of the performance, Sheeran launched a similar campaign to what's unfolding in Tokyo. Magenta everywhere. Local businesses converted into merch tables. Ipswich, England became, excuse the pun, Ipswich, Edland.
And it absorbed the community. It made it more like even if you didn't have tickets, it made it an event you could enjoy.
After her experience at the show, Debenham, a marketing expert, became curious about his appeal and the commercial machine behind it all. She penned what appears to be the only comprehensive marketing analysis of Sheeran's brand and came to the conclusion that these community takeovers, like in Ipswich and now in Tokyo, are essential to his appeal. They invite people to be part of something.
Ed has a really good marketing strategy in that he absorbs the community. And that's what I feel he does, not only with his marketing, but with his music. It's universal. Anyone can like Ed Sheeran. Very rarely is it offensive in any way. It's very easy to listen to, regardless of your sort of mood or frame of mind. There's songs there for everyone.
But how this will affect the moods of Tokyo commuters who are used to packing into rush hour trains like sardines and riding in complete silence, that remains an open question. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
One more headline before we sign off today. Brazil's Supreme Court has found former President Jair Bolsonaro guilty of attempting a military coup to stay in power in 2022. The plot included plans to assassinate current president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. We'll have full coverage of that news tomorrow.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. You can also find our original reporting on YouTube. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.